WBMC HD3 Detroit, KMPS HD3 Seattle, WBMX HD3 Boston,
and on AOL Radio
and Yahoo Launchcast.
CBS Radio's The New Sky.
Enlightened philosophers tell us that we are divine beings in human form. Let's get real here. How can we live a busy life with a job, kids, and a mortgage and still be spiritual? Join CJ Liu as she tackles real life issues through a spiritual lens and talks with experts in relationships, work, and more. You'll get practical life skills and learn how to touch, feel, and experience a whole new way of living. Be a force for good. And fire it up with CJ. Log on, fireitupwithcj.com, and call CJ now.
248-545-SOUL.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
And we are live here at CBS New Sky Radio, New Horizons, No Boundaries, and it is Fire It Up with CJ. Make sure you find her away from the show, of course. It is www.fireitupwithcj.com. So no excuses for not remembering that URL right there. Now, today we're going to begin April with a focus on the environment. So we'll send it to CJ.
Thank you, Brandon. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Fire It Up with CJ show. So as I said in the intro, we're really tackling real-life issues using a spiritual lens. And so one of the real-life issues that we face right now is the environment. And sometimes, for me at least, it feels so hopeless and frustrating. And I wanted to shine a glimmer of light and hope for all of us out there that want to hear something hopeful. And really, why is this on a spiritual show? Why is the environment on a spiritual show? Because it's all connected. You know, if we are all one, the way that we treat the planet that we're on and the animals and plants and people on it, it makes a difference. And so today we're going to be talking to Eileen Quigley, director of the New Energy Cities Program in Seattle. And she's going to give us a quick update on what's happening with the environment on a national level. And then we're really going to drill down into what's happening at the local level. So welcome, Eileen.
Hey there, CJ. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
And Eileen is a total trooper. She has like about 500 different things going on at this point, including sending two kids to Nepal, getting food poisoning. So I'm so grateful that you're here.
All good. It's all good. Feeling fine now.
Okay. So tell me, let's get back into a sickening position. What's happening with Obama right now? What can we expect best case by the end of this term, do you think?
Well, you know, I work on climate change, and so I view when I think about the environment, I'm thinking primarily about global warming and climate and its impact on the world and our environment that way. Here at Climate Solutions, which is where my program is nested, we see ourselves now in what we call an era of consequences when it comes to global warming, which is probably readily apparent to all of your listeners when you consider the climate disruptive events of just last year alone. Tornadoes, fires that couldn't be controlled, hurricanes, Sandy as well as others, melting polar ice caps, and of course the highest temperatures on record in history since they've been recorded. So from my point of view, when I work on climate change and clean energy, my best hope would be that President Obama would follow through on exactly what he said he would do in his State of the Union speech, and I'll quote a piece of it, which was he said, "We will respond to the threat of climate change knowing that failure to do so would betray our children and future generations. Mm-hmm. Americans cannot resist this transition, the transition to a clean energy economy. We must lead it." So best case scenario is we would see President Obama leading. He would say no to the Keystone Pipeline, which from our point of view would be game over for our planet. If we burn the oil from the tar sands that are in Canada that would come through that pipeline, it's very dirty oil and it's a lot of it. So that's not good. Mm-hmm. He would use his executive power to work around Congress. As we all know, we have challenges with Congress. From our point of view, Congress is in the pocket of the fossil fuel industry and determined to block all efforts at national climate policy. So, from our point of view, we would like to see President Obama use all of the tools in his executive power, including the tools he has with the EPA and others of his agencies, to restrict greenhouse gas emissions and pollutants from all existing and any new coal power plants. and enable renewable energy and energy efficiency to scale throughout the country.
Mm. Well, how's it going so far based on a couple of months into his term?
Well, so far, I mean, one of the things that's interesting that we're taking a lot of encouragement from, President Obama has been out in the hustings. He is doing a form of a listening tour, and he's essentially decided, part of my recommendation of his going around Congress, he appears to be following through, not that I've recommended it to him, but it seems though his staff and he have concluded that they're not getting very far back in the Beltway. And so they're out in the country, and they're talking, and they're paying attention. Mm-hmm. And I am hopeful. Because I do believe that President Obama is serious. I don't think he would have mentioned climate and the clean energy economy in his State of the Union speech if he weren't serious. And so the question is, how is he going to do it? And I also think he's smart, and his team is smart, and they're tactical, and they're strategic. So I'm hopeful. And then, of course, what I see going on out here in the hustings and the state level and at the city level gives me hope, and I think that when he and his staff are out and about talking to all of us, I think they're going to also see that there's a lot more to be gained by supporting clean energy economy than not.
So tell us on the state level, what gives you hope on the state level?
Well, I'm particularly excited about both the West Coast and East Coast leadership that we see. You know, starting back in 2005, we had the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in the Northeast, and that has created a viable carbon market in the Northeast. And Massachusetts, New York, Vermont, Rhode Island are all thriving with clean energy strategies. And Massachusetts has a green community strategy that is a model for the nation. New York is doing extraordinary things. So that's very exciting. And then out here on the West Coast, we have this exciting alignment among our new governor, Jay Inslee of Washington, and then Governor John Kitzhaber of Oregon, and then, of course, Jerry Brown in California, who have alignment on the importance of addressing climate. And California has demonstrated significant climate policy leadership, starting with its Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006. And coming out of that act, we now see a viable carbon market in California. So I'm excited about the possibility of a West Coast alliance, some kind of carbon market. And the most important thing about the carbon market, whether you tax it or whatever mechanism you use, the key is that it's an economy-wide approach to addressing carbon. And if you make this work economically, then I think many other aspects of addressing climate change will follow that.
So, as an end consumer, how would we get exposure to the carbon market? How does it work?
Well, it depends on what we decide to do, and I don't know. There's lots of activity right now. There are bills in both the Oregon, there's one bill in the Oregon legislature, and there's been a lot of discussion up here in Washington about what kind of bills we might do, talking about carbon tax, talking about cap and trade. Not sure where that's all gonna play out over the next 2 to 3 years. The average consumer would certainly feel, and again, it depends on what the policy is. Some of these carbon tax proposals would return money, this is called the tax and dividend, would return money back to consumers. So they'd be taxed for the carbon use, say at the pump, or more likely the oil and gas industry and the fossil fuel industries would be taxed for their carbon pollution. And then the money could be returned in the way of dividends. Also, what we've seen in Massachusetts through the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative is the development of the program I mentioned before, the Massachusetts Green Communities Program. And in that case, the money that's being raised through the cap and trade system, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative system, is flowing money to communities all over Massachusetts, which are then in turn investing in renewable energy and energy efficiency and economic development on a local level. So that's the most likely way that people would start to see it. They'd see it in terms of a change in their air quality, a change in their quality of life, and then a change in jobs in their community, and hopefully even in new manufacturing and new opportunities for people to invest in different technologies that are cleaner and healthier.
So I'm going to go a step back because you said that you're hopeful that Washington, Oregon, and California will have this alignment. So are you saying that alignment and strategy, or to like how does Washington, Oregon, and California working together help us?
Well, first of all, we do already have an alignment in that we have three governors who have stated, are on the record, and in fact are actually working actively on climate. So right there, that's hopeful. In terms of how you actually, whether we would have Washington and Oregon go their own way with their own mechanisms, or whether we would figure out how we might actually align ourselves with California and adopt the same cap and trade market mechanisms that are active now in California. That's actually what's really on the table right now and is being discussed and is likely to get worked out in the next few years. I think that there is enormous cross-border conversation going on, so it's right now, because Jay Inslee is so recently elected and Governor Kitzhaber is back after having been off, he's back been a couple of years, we're really at the early stages of figuring out what it looks like.
Okay, so we actually have a couple more minutes left, so a quick question.
Okay.
So cities. So, and I'm just trying to do kind of a little telescoping lens, and so
sure. It
seems like when I'm hearing about what happened on the federal level, it feels somewhat desperate, and I know that you're hopeful, and I'm
right.
hopeful.
At a minimum, it's certainly paralyzed.
Yeah, it is. And I don't know. I mean, what does a listening tour do? I don't know. So it gives President Obama, cred because people really care about the environment. Doesn't he have that already? I mean, what does a listening tour do?
Well, I agree with you. I think, we sort of wait and see. But I think maybe I'm misleading you by calling it just a listening tour, because that sounds like it's just a sop that's being thrown. I think it's much deeper than that. I think what they're doing is they're getting out into the states and into the cities, and they're seeing the kind of work that's going on and that's exciting.
Okay.
And they're figuring out how to, and this is really gets more clearly into the work that I actually do. I mean, what I feel we're doing down here at the ground level is building the support for the clean energy economy that, from a sort of grassroots level, or at least a bottoms up approach, then
right.
makes it more viable. And that's,
so he gets
and
case
it is
studies.
Exciting, you know.
Yeah, so he gets case studies. By traveling around, he gets case studies and examples
right.
of how at a federal level they could actually implement something bigger and more, so they can, here's what's working, here's what's not. That's what he would get by doing a listening
well,
tour.
I
it's not
think,
just like a kumbaya moment.
Right, no, not at all. And I also think that the Beltway is a bubble, right? I mean, everybody back there is in their own world, and they get to have lunch and dinner with all the lobbyists and all the rest. And I think sometimes you can get a pretty distorted view about what's actually going on.
Mm-hmm.
And if you actually come out of D.C. and you get out into communities and you see the excitement and the success and the economic development of the clean energy economy, I think then you can go back perhaps emboldened and recognize
right.
that you should do something. Because in the absence of national energy climate policies, the action really is at the states and the cities. And so... Mm-hmm. It is a much more hopeful place to be than the Beltway.
Yeah, yeah. And then going back to the states, and then when we come back, we're going to be talking all about the cities. But
okay.
the states, so it sounds like the issues with the states and really is about kind of, again, best practices and coordination in some ways mm-hmm. because of this cap and trade. Is that what it is? It's like coordination of how that economy would work across
right. I mean,
borders?
So the exciting aspect of having a viable cap and trade market in the Northeast already, and a new market in California, and potentially other cap and trade or some kind of carbon pricing. We're not quite sure mm-hmm. what it'll end up being, but if we're proving it at the state level, and we're talking about big population centers. I mean, California
mm-hmm.
itself. An economy larger than many countries, and then also on the East Coast, high concentration of population. So the
mm-hmm.
hope would be that if we can actually prove that carbon pricing is a viable economic model that drives not only revenue but also clean energy development, then potentially you could see another go at carbon pricing at the national level that would have a unified national approach.
The climate problem needs
that. To address climate,
yeah, okay.
we need a much bigger system.
All right. I've been told I need to go on break. So we're going to we have Eileen Quigley, director of the New Energy Cities Program in Seattle, and we're going to be talking about in the next segment some really cool things that are happening that hopefully Obama will see on his listening tour. So folks online, make sure to subscribe to us by going to www.firedupwithcj.com, and you'll get a schedule of upcoming shows. We'll be right back.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
The Sky.
Now back to Fire It Up with CJ. Be a force for good. And fire it up with CJ. Log on fireitupwithcj.com and call CJ now.
248-545-7685.
On CBS Radio's The Sky. Sky.
Welcome back, and we're live here at CBS Radio's The Sky, New Horizons, No Boundaries. It's Fire It Up with CJ, which you can actually now find the podcast over at iTunes. So make sure you check that out. Our guest today, Eileen Quigley, educating us on one of today's most pressing topics, climate change. It's Brandon filling in for Cassandra today. We'll get things back over to CJ and Eileen.
Hey, thank you, Brandon. So welcome back, everybody. We are talking about climate change. And as Eileen so aptly said in the previous segment, we are in the era of consequences, which means that we have seen tornadoes, floods, record heat waves, droughts. And I know, actually, a lot of my relatives on the East Coast are still disputing that climate change is real. I kind of am shocked, but still, I think that there's still people who don't believe that it's true. And so my question for folks out there who are still kind of questioning this is, what will be the cost if we don't act? You know, if you read what people say, there's loss of food production, infectious disease, air pollution, and what is the risk that we don't do anything? That's kind of how I look at it as a life coach. So enough of doom and gloom. Let's get back to hopeful. But that's just a ploy to please take this seriously. Welcome back, Eileen Quigley, director of New Energy City Program in Seattle. So welcome back, Eileen.
Hey there.
So tell us when we were talking about what's happening at the federal and state level. How do cities fit into the picture?
Well, you know, cities are really ground zero when it comes to climate change. We're expecting 80% of humanity living in urban environments now, and they account for about 70% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And that number is only expected to increase as countries.
Read that. Tell me again. 80% live in urban environments, and they're accounting for 70% of greenhouse emissions.
70% of all global greenhouse gas emissions are emitted by people who live in cities throughout the world.
Okay, got it. So it's not just us here in the United States.
It's a global picture. But that also means that working on climate change at the city level is mission critical. So the other aspect of cities is that there's a great deal of innovation at the local level, and it's quite possible, and of course it's part of the theory of change for my program, that we will be able to drive change from the bottom up. So the focus of my program, the New Energy Cities Program, which is based here in Seattle and is a program of climate solutions, is on small to medium-sized cities. We chose to work with them because we saw them as needing the support the most. We think that the larger cities, you know, the Seattles, the Portlands, Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, the big cities are getting there on their own, and they're very well staffed. And in fact, those communities that I just mentioned, those cities are in fact leading in the country and are cities we look to for guidance when we have designed our own program. But when we look at the small to medium-sized communities, we see a real need for assistance. The other thing.
Okay, before you go on, tell the audience what size is a small to medium-sized city, the population.
We work with communities that are under 250,000, and we're generally in the range of somewhere between 60 to 120, 130, but we have worked in very small communities. We've worked in communities of sizes of 9,000 and 10,000, and then also we've been involved in the city of Boise, which is bumping up against 250. So that's the range for us, the cutoff that we chose was 250,000.
Right, and so for a city that small, they really don't have a budget. They don't have the budget and the resources to put together a whole planning committee to focus on climate change. I see. So that's where you guys come in.
Correct. And also, and sustainability coordinators, or even the funding to be able to send staff to conferences to get educated. And so we do need to have somebody on the staff, if not a sustainability director or if not a climate change planner, somebody whose job it is to focus on this. So that's an important component. But sometimes that'll be the head of the Department of Public Works, or the head of the transportation department, or environmental services, or the city manager sometimes.
Right. So you work with advocates to help educate them and kind of share best practices. Got it. Okay. So tell us a little bit about some of the kind of cool things that are happening out there.
Well, you know, there are a lot of very interesting developments. We were talking a little bit before about what the Obama administration could do going forward, but one of the things the Obama administration did in the last, in its first administration, was fund a fair amount of clean energy innovation throughout the country. And those grants, they were administered through the Department of Energy and became part of what's known as the Better Buildings Program, turned out to be quite significant and quite useful as almost starter fuel for a lot of communities. Some of the communities that we've worked with received that funding, and some that we didn't. But what we've seen is enormous amount of innovation that was unleashed by being given these grants, that you had to bring together your community members and figure out a plan for sustainable energy. Last summer, we wrote a report, my team and I wrote a report called Powering the New Energy Future from the Ground Up, Profiles in City-Led Clean Energy Innovation. And we looked at 34 communities throughout the country that had really gone the distance, done something very, very interesting with their funding. And so we could talk about some examples of that, or I could talk about closer.
Yeah, I want to loop back. If you live in a community that didn't get this funding, is that because it wasn't a priority, or like what was the amount of funding that an example of the funding that they would get?
So the cities actually had to write grants for it, and so if you got it, usually you had some kind of a clean energy vision. You had been able to organize your community, your private sector as well as your public sector folks, and get them all to say, yes, this is something that we want, and we're going to support it, and we'll match the money. So they were leveraged grants. A lot of the real innovators in the countries were the ones who probably have had a clean energy focus for the last 5 to 6 years, and not ones that are starting to think about it in 2013 or 2012.
Right, got it. And so tell us a little bit about Issaquah. And I know you're excited about Issaquah. Tell us about what they did and why it's so important.
Right. So the city of Issaquah is a bedroom community in Seattle, has lots of people who work at Microsoft there and Boeing and other big employers around here in King County. And they're a very interesting community because, unlike some communities have set meaningful greenhouse gas emissions goals, but they haven't then said, how are we actually going to get there? And out here in King County, Washington, set a goal back in 2007. They looked at the climate science, and they determined what would be needed to stabilize the climate, and, in fact, was one of the first in the nation to actually do that. And King County set a goal of reducing carbon emissions to 80% of their levels in 2007 by the year 2050. And Issaquah was one of several cities in King County that adopted the same goal. But where Issaquah took this another step forward is that their mayor and their staff then kind of looked at each other and said, okay, that's great. We committed to that goal, but how do we actually do it? And so that's where we came in. They called us up and they specifically asked us that question. They said, we've set this goal, but we don't even know what it means. And they also said, frankly, can we do it? Are we even sure? I mean, did we sign up for something that we don't even know if we're capable of doing?
Right.
One of Issaquah's interesting challenges is that they are a growth city. They are growing very quickly. So they've set this really significant, ambitious greenhouse gas emissions reduction goal at the same time that they also have pretty ambitious growth patterns. So it's a double challenge for them. But the good news is that it looks to us as though they can achieve it. And so what we do is we look at their energy uses and sources in the community. So we talk to the utilities and we say, okay, how much energy and which form is this community using? Is it gas? Is it oil? Is it hydroelectric? Is it renewable? And we look at, so those are all the kind of the sources. And then we use a energy mapping technique that is able to tell the city exactly where all of that energy is used.
Interesting. Right? And, you know, we actually have to go on break, so I want to continue because I think it's fascinating to just hear your process of what you've been doing on Issaquah. So the next segment, we continue talking to Ellen Quigley, Director of New Energy City Program in Seattle, and we're going to be talking about a couple of other innovative programs and specifically what they did in Issaquah to help them achieve their goals. So this is fantastic, right? So, folks, make sure to go to www.fireitupwithcj.com to subscribe to be eligible for freebies and to get a schedule of upcoming shows, articles, and coaching tips. We'll be right back.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
The Sky.
Now back to Fire It Up with CJ. Be a force for good. And fire it up with CJ. Log on fireitupwithcj.com and call CJ now.
248-545-7685.
On CBS Radio's The Sky.
Sky. And welcome back. Thank you for joining us. It is Fired Up with CJ, and today we have Ellen Quigley, Director of the New Energy Cities Program in Seattle. You can find her at newenergycities.org, also climatesolutions.org. And you can find more shows just like this one over at fireitupwithcj.com. Now, it's Brandon here. I'm filling in for Cassandra. We'll get things right back over to CJ and Ellen.
Hey, thank you, Brandon. So, hi, everybody. Welcome to Fire It Up with CJ Show. So, for those of you who have been frustrated by the lack of progress at the national level, we are talking about some really interesting innovations that are happening at the city level. And before the break, we were talking about Issaquah, who has signed up for 80% of its having its carbon emissions be 80% of the level that it was in 2007 by 2050. Which is a pretty challenging goal because they are growing very quickly. And Ellen was saying that she's been, you know, rolling up her sleeves and figuring out how they're going to achieve that goal. And the first part she said was looking at the energy uses and sources and where's the energy coming from. And then continue, Ellen, tell us more.
Okay, so we were looking at sort of the sources where we were saying, is it coal, is it gas, is it oil, is it hydro, and each of which has different GHG values. And then where is the energy used? Is it residential? Is it commercial? Is it industrial buildings? Is it transportation? Just looking at where all that carbon ends up, where all that energy ends up being used. And so we create these energy maps, which are pictures that mayors love because they can show them to the people and they can show them at city council and say, here's how much energy we used community-wide, not just the city, and here's what we're using it on, and here's our carbon emissions, and here's the path we're on. And so what we do and what we're doing specifically with a city like Issaquah is we then take that picture and we say, okay, because every city is different, right? Every city has a different mix of buildings. Every city has a different population, different industrial base, everything. So we say, okay, with Issaquah, 70% of their emissions is actually coming from, actually 66.4% of their emissions is coming from their building sector. And that's different.
Oh, wow.
You know, nationally, usually there's a little more in transportation than in buildings.
Right.
So we then say to them, okay, we take a graph and we say, okay, here's your goal. You've said, here's where you want to be, in 2050. And that has a particular value in carbon emissions. And here's where you're headed if you keep going at your current levels, which we call business as usual. Mm-hmm. And basically, if you're looking at a graph, that where you keep going, business as usual is way up there in the top right quadrant, and where they need to go is way down there in the lower right quadrant.
Right.
So then you've got this big, what we call a wedge, and you say, okay, this is your nut to crack. How are you going to do it? Then we look at the federal laws that are already on board or state laws. And in the case of, again, the Obama administration, one of its singular achievements of its last go-round was tightening the CAFE standards so that we will have cars that will be operating at upwards of 54 miles per gallon in the future. So that's going to impact our carbon. So we map that. We have energy codes that are going to impact. We have standards that require renewable power. We take everything that's already on the books and we say, okay, Issaquah, look how far you get without having done anything. Between the state and the feds, you're already here, and that's a point on the graph. And then we say, okay, now what are you going to do? And then we actually get into very specific. Here are the things you can do in the built environment. Here's what you can do with transportation. Here's what you can do with water and waste. Different strategies. Each has a range of cost, a degree of difficulty, and a carbon value. And then we do a priority setting process. We also look at carbon storage, too, which is taking carbon out of the air through photosynthesis with trees and greening the environment. And we also take that into account, too, and cities that do more of that can increase their carbon storage, and that will impact their carbon emissions.
Honestly, it sounds like a great process and sounds extremely practical, right? It's like, it's like a budgeting process. Here's your budget. Figure out how you're going to spend it. You have these already baked in solutions that, God bless you on figuring out how to do these, but you're going to do them regardless. And then let's try to do these other things. I think it's fantastic. It's exciting.
Yeah.
All right. So tell
us. It is very practical.
Yeah, it's extremely it's a budgeting process. All of us have to go through it. We have a budget and you have to meet it. So figure out what choices you're going to have to make. All right. So
the other thing I want to say about the CJ that's really important is it really gives these cities tools to go to their communities and say, okay, what do we want to do and why? And here are the parameters instead of blue skying it. And that's too hard, right? You bring a bunch of people together and you say, let's do it. And they're going to be like, well, tell us how.
Yeah.
And this gives them choices.
Yeah, and they can choose choose what you want. Do you want to actually, have a built environment, transportation? But then if you choose this, then these are the consequences that you have to live by because you chose this, right? And we have this goal. So everyone, be in partnership to work together to figure that out. And that's exactly, it sounds like what places like Oberlin and Fort Collins have done. Tell us about the interesting partnerships that they've done.
Right. So the goal setting part is really, really crucial, as we've already talked about, and that's a key tenet of our program. So in Oberlin, they had actually set – their first goal they set was to be 50% below 2007 levels by 2015, which they're already on target. But then they wanted to also generate 90% of their energy from renewable energy sources, which is huge. And then, not to be outdone, they decided to – they also wanted to be carbon neutral by 2050 and carbon positive – after that, which would mean they would bring their GHG emissions down to below zero. So they're not kidding. Oberlin is not fooling around. They created something called the Oberlin Project, and they became part of the Clinton Foundation's Climate Positive Development Program, and they did a whole bunch of community involvement. They partnered with their local municipal light and power utility. They determined that they would conserve 20,000 acres of green space, that they're going to develop a robust local food economy that will meet 70% of the community's food consumption. And what's critical about that in terms of GHG is that means you're not shipping and trucking a lot of food in flying food and then trucking food in. Plus, of course, it's good carbon storage too. They developed a green arts district that is platinum LEED, which means that it's at the highest standards of energy efficiency. And, of course, they've partnered hand in glove with the College of Oberlin. And on Oberlin itself is trying to also is leading the charge in getting to this climate positive. And finally, they've gone into the schools. And this is a really important point. Getting sustainability instruction, talking about how to live your lives differently in the public school, in the elementary, and it doesn't matter whether public or private, but in elementary and secondary level is very, very important. Raising that awareness at a young age and instilling in students the values of the sustainability will carry them through the rest of their life, and that's very important. So Oberlin,
I love that part.
I think it's very interesting work.
Yeah. Okay. So how does a city like Oberlin accomplish this? They must have a charismatic leader. I mean, how did this happen?
Well, they do. They have charismatic leaders, and the cities that we see, they're kind of four keys to success. You got to have bold, committed political leadership, or university leadership, or some community leader who's listened to, who's bold and committed. You got to have a business community that sees the value of the clean energy economy. You have to have a utility that's going to collaborate, because we need to work with the utilities, can't work against them. And then you got to have the citizenry that's saying, yes, sustainability matters to me. Yes, the environment matters to us. Yes, we want to do something about global climate change. And when you have those factors, you have success.
Mm. What was the business community for Oberlin that was involved? Or was that the college, which is also kind of their mainstay business
there? Well, yeah, there's the college and then this Green Arts District, which was all of the people in the arts of Oberlin were involved in that. The college is a big driver. Oberlin is very much, I wouldn't say dominated by the college, but it's a huge part of the economy
right.
of the city. So that
right.
was a key partner. And Fort Collins right. is another example. If we have time for that, do you want me to talk about that?
Yeah, we have. Darn, we only have 1 minute. Ah! Okay, we'll have to.
Okay. That was a really big, you know, public partnership with the New Belgium Brewery, Water Utility, Colorado State University, and they wanted to produce a energy district that would produce more energy than it would use. So that was also a hugely innovative partnership, public-private partnership. In a city.
We probably just increased people wanting to move there at this point.
Both very cool towns.
You could go to Oberlin and still be able to brush your teeth and get some light. Exactly. Okay, a big thanks to Eileen Quigley, Director of New Energy Cities Program in Seattle. In the next segment, we're going to be talking about practical tips and actions that you can take if you care about global warming. So folks online, make sure to go to www.fireduppwithcj.com and subscribe to be eligible for freebies and get a schedule of upcoming shows, articles, and coaching tips. We'll be right back.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
The Sky.
Now back to Fire It Up with CJ. Be a force for good. And Fire It Up with CJ. Log on, fireitupwithcj.com, and call CJ now.
248-545-7685.
Believe. On CBS Radio's The Sky. Sky.
Welcome back. Fire It Up with CJ here at The Sky. New Horizons, No Boundaries. Joined today by Seattle expert on climate change, Eileen Quigley, director of the New Energy Cities program. Make sure you find her again over at newenergycities.org, also climatesolutions.org. And speaking of climate solutions, we're about to discuss the steps you can take to become a part of the solution. Once again, it's Brandon filling in for Cassandra. We'll get things back over to CJ and Eileen.
So welcome back to the Fire It Up with CJ show on CBS Sky Radio. I'm CJ Liu, and we are talking about what you can do if you want to be part of the solution for climate change. And we have Eileen Quigley here, who is the director of New Energy Cities Program. Welcome back, Eileen.
Hey there.
So tell us a little bit about your own personal story and how you started getting activated with climate change.
Well, there were sort of two factors at the same time. The first was that I'm from New York City originally. My family's from there. And so when 9/11 happened and I watched the World Trade Center's towers falling in my hometown, I lost college and grad school classmates, and I lost two cousins in those towers. And I was working for a high-tech company back here in Seattle at the time. And as I watched that, I swore I would dedicate my life to figuring out how we could wean ourselves of our addiction to fossil fuel, because I believed that the hatred that feeds Al-Qaeda is a direct result of our horrific history of invading countries and siding with dictators to protect our oil interests. So I was completely opposed to both of our Iraq wars, and I just became determined to try and make us as free of Middle Eastern oil as possible. But the other thing that was going on at the same time is, of course, in the early parts of 2000, it was increasingly obvious to me that the environmental danger of fossil fuel dependence was as compelling as our national security interests. I was very worried about warming the planet. So those two things were happening at the same time. So my desire to preserve our country from national security threats and my commitment to reducing GHG emissions is what, you know, keep our planet from burning up, make our air and water clean. It's what inspires me to do what I do, and so I came to Climate Solutions, and they hired me.
Well, wait, so did you quit your job working at this high-tech company, and you had this awful experience, and then you thought, but I'm going to be part of the solution, and you quit your job and joined climate change?
I didn't actually get to Climate Solutions until about, came in here around 2008, 2009, so it took me a while to get there. It took me a couple of years to get around to it, but I did.
Wow. Well, that's powerful. Okay, so one of the things, that's an incredible story, and I think it goes back to the thing that you were saying in the previous segment, that citizens really have to be involved and active,
mm-hmm.
In order to make a difference. I mean, we can sit around hoping that other people will fix a problem for us, but it really involves making steps, you know, taking steps ourselves. So
that's right.
And believing that it makes a difference to us, yeah.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about some of the job opportunities that are possible if we go down this. You know, for an end consumer, what are some possibilities for us?
Well, I think there are lots of reasons to get involved in climate. I think at the very least, with the country seemingly so stalled on so many fronts, it's actually a positive thing in one's life to actually take a step forward and do something positive, and then you're can be very pleased with what happens as a result of that. There are all kinds of jobs that are being created by the clean energy economy, and the state of Massachusetts saw a 6% statewide economic growth during this great recession when most of the country was struggling, an 11.2% increase in clean energy jobs. This is 71,000 jobs in 2012, yes, at a time when the rest of the country was struggling, or different parts of the country were struggling more. So there's jobs for contractors, there's jobs for electricians, there's jobs in solar installation, there's all kinds of manufacturing jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you decide you're going to do 80% of your community, make 80% of your community energy efficient over a 20-year period, those jobs can't be outsourced.
Mm-hmm.
Those houses are right
mm-hmm.
here, and there's
mm-hmm.
plenty of work. So there's a lot of exciting economic development, certainly on the job front.
Okay, so and tell us, we have a couple more minutes left, so tell us a little bit about, you know, what should we do, or how should we think about this?
Well, you know,
I mean, ourselves.
We say that, particularly last year with these terrible weather events, it's like the alarm has gone off and we're all lying in bed and we're trying to decide, are we going to hit snooze or are we going to get up? And people are afraid to get up. They're afraid that it's going to be so awful if we can't live our high fossil fuel dependent life. And that's completely
mm-hmm.
wrong. The great news is that the coffee is actually great. The breakfast is great.
At least in Seattle.
Okay. That's right. That's so Seattle. We say it's like there's pie for breakfast.
mm-hmm.
Because the opportunities in the clean energy economy are real, and we are seeing it everywhere that we are working. The opportunities for cleaning up our air, cleaning up our water, and fundamentally saving our planet. And every action that we see each other taking in, our cities taking in the positive direction is returning many times over. So I'd say what we need to do as a nation is take our democracy back from the fossil fuel industry. It has a stranglehold on our leaders, and we need it back. People should support citizens, politicians, corporations, students, the military, teachers, nonprofits, religious groups, hunters, anglers. All these people are working on clean energy solutions. And when people see that, they should either get involved themselves or support those who are, and get educated and get involved to demand clean energy and climate smart solutions. It's good for the economy and it's good for the environment.
We actually just retrofitted our whole house, and not only is our house warmer, our energy bills lower, but it didn't cost that much money relative. I mean, the return on investment
right.
on these kind of things, because the city is investing so heavily right,
right
now, you get a really
right.
quick return on investment on these kind of retrofitting things. Your
home value just increased significantly too, which is another key piece of this that people are beginning to realize. All that retrofitting
yeah.
increases the value of your home.
That's true. That's true. So if folks want to give a donation to your organization, how would they do that?
Climatesolutions.org and there's definitely donation opportunities. Just donate. There's a donate button right there on the homepage.
Okay. Okay. Got it. And then if they were interested in your particular program, is that, do they donate through, Climate Solutions?
Well, newenergycities.org is the direct URL. So www.newenergycities.org.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much, Eileen, especially given all that you have going on right now. Eileen Quigley, director of the New Energy City Program here in Seattle. So join us next week when we continue focusing on the environment. We talk to Dr. Will Hewitt, author of Amazon's number one best-selling book, The World Peace Diet. So have a great weekend, everybody. And thank you, Brendan.
Thanks so much, CJ.
Thanks so much, Eileen.